Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2013. Lecture 4, delivered on January 24, 2013. The title of this lecture is Interest Rates, Financial Intermediaries, and the Federal Reserve.
Today, interest rates, financial intermediaries, and the Federal Reserve. Interest rates, financial intermediaries, and the Federal Reserve. And to begin this lecture, I want to hire you for a job, okay? It's $10, okay, you, $8 an hour, and you'll work for me, let's say, 20 hours a week, and I'll pay you for what you do. Now, that wage that I'm paying you, am I buying you? Or am I renting you? Yeah, I'm renting. I'm not even renting you. I'm renting your services. I don't buy people in the sense that when we talk about a price, if I said, what's your price? Well, $8 an hour. That's not really a price. That's a rate on an hourly basis. Sometimes I'll use the word price, but what I really mean is a rental rate. Wages are the rental rate on human capital, on labor. In the same way, interest rates are actually the price of money. But really not a price, it's a rental rate on money. So when I talk about an interest rate, what I'm talking about is a rental rate. Just like I could rent you. I could rent you for services. But I don't buy you. In the same way as if you lent me money at 8%, that's a rental rate of 8% per year. I'm not buying the money from you. I'm renting it from you. So when I say interest rate, I'm talking about a rental rate on money. Really? Okay. Now, I'm going to write some things down here. I'm going to put in scare quotes, interest rate. But you know as well as I do that there is no such thing as the interest rate. There are many interest rates out there in the world. There's the interest rate on a car loan. There's the interest rate on a home loan. There's the interest rate on your student loan. There's the interest rate on a payday loan or something like that. So there are all these different interest rates out there. Sometimes we use the word, another word that sometimes we'll use is the word yield. Now, unless I say differently, this is always an annualized kind of thing. So if I say 8%, that means 8% per year. Or the yield is 4.26%. That's a yearly yield, an annualized yield. So know that to begin with. Okay. The interest rate. Let's start building an interest rate. First things first. The first interest rate that we would ever see, and you got to watch me here because I still use the old notation R, and any more textbooks use a K for these, so watch me when I do this. If I slip to R, say something. Okay, the first interest rate that you would ever see is this K sub F. This is the risk-free rate. It would be the rate if there were no risk at all in lending the money. Now, almost all kinds of lending have some risk in them. And there are a couple of different sources of risk, which we'll talk about in a minute. But this would be the very first rate you would ever see would be the rate on something that had no risk whatsoever in it. The closest we have in the real world to an actual risk-free rate would be on a treasury bill. Because they will pay off. They'll pay. There's no question that that thing is going to deliver back to you when it reaches maturity. If the government doesn't have the money, it'll simply tax to get the money, or it will just attack another country and take its money. One way or the other, it will get its money. It will get its money to pay you back. So, the T-bill is a risk-free rate, but inside of that rate, are actually a couple of little pieces which we really can't ever see, although there are ways that we can get kind of tease them out. But inside of this risk-free rate are two pieces. One of those is called the real rate of return. The real rate of return, K sub R. This thing is actually the opportunity cost of foregone consumption. If you lend me $20 today, that means you don't have $20 for a cheeseburger and fries. You see, you have to be rewarded for giving up consumption. Has to be something in there. Because otherwise, you are deprived of the use of the money and you have nothing to gain for it. So there has to be a reward at the base of everything else. That case of R there, that real rate of return, is driven by the supply of and demand for money, which I'll get to in a minute. But it is driven by the supply of and demand for money. It is the opportunity cost of foregone consumption. It is your reward. It is the way we get money from you to lend to a deficit economic unit. Surplus units will not give up their money unless there's something in exchange for it. They're not stupid. Something has to be there. I want to point out something real quick here. This is actually a Western capitalist concept. There's another finance theory called Islamic finance where interest rates are forbidden and charging interest for money. In that system, you would have to rearrange the whole concept and begin to look at shared profit from enterprises that had money lent to them. So although there are many Western economists who say, oh, it's just a variation on our a Western capitalist system, it really isn't quite. So I would caution you that if you run into Islamic finance, which is big in some parts of the world and growing rapidly, in the Middle East and parts of Asia, you would see a slightly different thing. That's just a caution. Now, the other part of the risk-free rate is this piece called, and we designate it with a pi e. This is expected inflation. Expected inflation. This is the expectation of the erosion of purchasing power. The expectation of the erosion of purchasing power. And watch that word expected, because I might just say, oh, it's the inflation rate. No, it's the expected inflation rate, because the actual inflation rate really doesn't matter all that much. It's the expectation that bites us in the ass. Let me try this. Woman, you've gone to work for me. Okay? Now, I'm a generous employer. You're working full-time. You're a really great employee, so I pay you $100 a week. Okay? And you don't deserve that much, but obviously, you know, I'm that kind of guy. Okay, so you're coming up for your annual review. And I say, okay, well, you know, I want to be fair. Inflation last year was 2%. So I'm going to give you a 2% raise. So you're happy. You go out of there. You've got $2 more in your paycheck. Let the good times roll. Okay? So now you come back for your next annual review, and I look, well, you know, inflation last year was 4%. So I'm going to give you a 4% increase this year. Oh, yeah, uh-huh. And you walk out. Will you shut up? Really? Die. Die. There. Bite me. So now inflation for this year goes to 6%. And so you come back and you say, well, I say to you, okay, well, inflation last year was 6%. So I'm going to give you a 6% increase in your pay. What's wrong with what I am doing here with her? Is there anything wrong with the way I'm treating this employee? Okay, let me explain. 6% was what she suffered last year, and yet I'm rewarding that for this year. 4% was what she suffered the year before that, so I gave her 4% after 4% inflation. I gave her 6% after 6% inflation. Instead of that, you would, now we've gone from 2% to 4% to 6% inflation. What do you expect to happen for this next year? I'm giving you 6%, but what do you expect inflation to do to your income over the next year? What would you, take a guess? You want to give me a stab? What would you think? If it went 2, 4, 6, there's a pattern. Good! You got the pattern. Damn, woman. Yeah. 8%. I'm sorry about that. You're under pressure here. You got a guy with bad breath yelling at you, you know. You see, the problem is that now you say to me, now wait a minute there, Sparky. You call me Sparky? I'm your boss. Okay, asshole. You know, wait a minute. Let's go back to Sparky. Okay. You say, I want 8% for next year because I'm going to get my purchasing power is going to be eroded 8% over this coming year. And you're going to give me 6%? No. I want 8%. You will try to go towards an expectation, because if you're just lagging all the time, you're going to be losing all the time. Now, let's talk about a bank. Do you suppose a bank's going to wait and say, well, let's see that 8%, I'm going to charge you 6%, but I know 8% is going to be how much I lose on that next year. They're not going to do it that way. They're going to look forward and project by an expectation what is going to happen in the next period. That's how interest rates all work. They do, and most labor union contracts, back in the day when labor unions actually existed in reality, they would say, no, we're not talking about inflation last year. We want to talk about what's going to happen coming into this new contract. We're going to talk about the future, not what has already happened. Well, you say 8%, and I say, well, you know, I understand you, but I just heard this a news report by the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve said that it's going to get really tough on inflation, and so I don't think it's going to happen. You know, it went from 2 to 4, yeah, and it went from 4 to 6, yeah, and it went from 6 to, it probably go from 6 to 8, but I really believe the Fed is telling the truth, and it's going to crack down on inflation. How do you react to that? Be firm. You got to be tough in the business world. You got to stand up for yourself. Yes, because don't tell me what the promise is. In economics, this goes to one of the first rules of warfare. Never assume an opponent's intentions, only its capabilities. Only what you think it could do. We do not posture ourselves militarily or in business for what we think our people out there will do, what their best intentions are, what they say they'll do. We look at what they are capable of doing, what they have been doing so far. You finally got married. It's one of those great marriages. 20 years, it's been beautiful. And every evening, you come in, your wife gets back just a little before you do. You make dinner together, you sing little songs together. Your favorite song is You Are So Beautiful to Me. You have wine by candlelight. It's been the greatest relationship. Every night, it happens like this. Then, one night, you open the door, and the hallway is dark. It's never been dark before. You step in, honey? And she comes out wearing Ninja Warrior outfit with a Bushmaster AR-15. And she starts running at you, firing from it, and swinging swords at you. You barely jump out the door, close it, as knives go, tow, 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 and a shuriken goes right through the door and almost hits you in the ass. You run to your car. You jump in. You speed away. You hear shurikens hitting you the back of your car. Ching, ching, ching. You manage to get far away. It begins to rain. You're on this long road. The radio starts to play that song. You are so beautiful to me. The tears start to fall down your eyes. Can't you see? You're everything I hope for. And now you're fully, oh God. Do you turn around and go back?
Probably not.
I don't think so. She almost canned your ass. 20 years. What, she fired 10 bullets? That's less than one bullet on average a year. Are you going to make your next move based upon what has happened on average over 20 years? It was a half a bullet a year. You know, 10 bullets, 20 years. Or are you going to base your expectation on the latest behavior you observed? You better believe it. You see, that goes to that whole idea of replacement cost, that whole idea of expectations. We are driven not by the reality of the past, because the past has been eaten. There was even a Stephen King science fiction novel about that called The Langoliers, about being stuck in time and having to run from the Langoliers who eat the past. That's the way it is in our world. Nothing about what has already happened, only what we expect to happen. That's why I write here expectation of inflation. Interest rates are built upon the expectation of what will happen next. Not on the expectation of what has happened before. If you start falling into that pattern of thinking about the past and basing your actions upon the past, you are going to fall into the trap of the sunk cost fallacy. Essentially is what you're doing. You're looking at what has already happened, which really doesn't have a whole lot to do with what's going to come. Now, you can obviously assess the future based upon your experiences from the past, but you always have to be looking forward. That's why we write this expectation of inflation here, and it becomes very important in public policy with regard to monetary policy, which we get to here in a little bit. So this first interest rate, we've got this case of F that is essentially like the rock base that we can see. We proxy it. If someone says, well, give me the risk-free rate, the first thing that I would probably do is go and look at current yields on T-bills. And that would give me an idea of sort of the substrate of the entire economy, because no company, no person has an interest rate that would be that low, because there's always some risk in other instruments. But this one would be at the base. So that's why we keep an eye on Treasury bill rates, because essentially, whither they go, all other rates, which are essentially based on those, will go with them. Not exactly in a one-to-one fashion. There's all kinds of other things that go on. Okay, now, let's talk about interest rate. An actual interest rate that you would see somewhere out there besides in a T-bill. It will be started, the base of it is going to be case of F, the risk-free rate. That would be the lowest rate that anyone could get. That's the rate that the government gets on its shortest-term borrowings. And then we're going to have this big clobbering little cluster called the risk premium. These are the pieces that are tacked on to the risk-free rate that form an interest rate that you would see out there in the real world. The first one is the default premium. The default premium, case of D. Did you see I just spit on this? Can you see that? Cool. Case of D. The default premium. This is the risk This represents a reward for the risk that some or all of your cash flow is not going to get back to you. I'm going to charge a default premium because there is at least some risk that you're not going to pay me back. So I'm going to hit everyone with that because there is a small part of the group that would default. Maybe on some of the payments, maybe on the last payment. Some or all of the cash flow will not come back. So that default premium is in there. It can be very high. For you, it would be really high. No. Well, you look very reputable. No, he doesn't. Why did I even pick you? Okay, look. For you, you're a very creditworthy stud. So we're going. It wouldn't be very high for you. We don't do it like that, though. We don't aim it at people. We look more at the type of lending. So, for example, the default premium on a credit card would be pretty darned high just because a lot of people default on their credit card debt. Hell, I do. No, I don't. On the other hand, the default premium on commercial paper, remember I mentioned that last time, very large creditworthy companies. That would be pretty low. Now, although, remember that I told you that story about that company that blew off its commercial paper, that actually caused a little bit of a bump in the risk premium, in the default premium for all commercial paper. Give you an example. Let's try this. Okay, how about the default premium on a home mortgage? The interest rate on a home mortgage, would that have a big default premium in it or a small one? What would you say? It actually is a relatively small one for a couple of reasons. One is because a home loan is backed by a hard asset, a house. So even if they default, you got the asset back. Also, contrary to what you, almost no one knows this until they buy a home, is that when you get a home mortgage, part of your payment actually pays for an insurance policy for the bank so that if you default, the bank gets made whole. In other words, if you owe more than they can sell your house for, that insurance premium pays the difference. So the bank is actually covered several ways and you pay that mortgage that mortgage insurance premium. Interestingly, most people don't know it's there to begin with, even though they're told that it's there. It kind of goes over their head. And almost no one knows that the bank has to stop making you pay for that insurance premium when you go below a loan-to-value of 80%. Most people just keep paying on their loans, pay them off. They never realize that they could demand that that mortgage premium be pulled, that mortgage insurance premium be taken off when they go below a loan to value of 80%. It's kind of amazing how that racket works in this country. So if you hear crocodile tears about banks just suffering because people have defaulted on their loans, a lot of that is just, in technical terms, bullshit. Because they are covered with the asset itself and also with an insurance policy that the person was paying for to cover the spread between the liquidation of the house and the value of the mortgage still outstanding. But there you go. Okay, let's try a couple of more other ones. What would you say for a student loan? High or low default premium? It's very low because it's underwritten by the government. If it's underwritten by some entity, it's probably going to be a lower interest rate. And moreover, well, okay, I'll default on the government. I wouldn't if I were you. They have big-ass SWAT teams, okay? And you, so actually, in that case, it's actually a pretty low insurance. It's pretty low default premium. How about a car loan? High or low default premium on a car loan? What would you say on that one? You would say, okay, it's low because there's an asset backing it. The car, they'll just repo the car if you stop paying on it. If you default on the loan, they'll repo your car. You know how the way they do it with those guys dressed like ninjas, sneak up and take your car away in the middle of the night, all that kind of stuff. I was waiting for them. I was. It's amazing. They didn't seem to be interested in exchanging gunfire, but you know, but actually it is actually a little bit higher, simply because a car loses so much value when it goes off the lot. So if you buy a $20,000 car and you stop paying on it, you could say, yeah, they're going to take the car back and sell it, so they're made whole. Not really, because that car lost so much value going off the lot. When they sell it, they're going to lose money on it. So they're going to put a higher default premium on a car than you would than they would on a home, for example. And so that's why you see all these different interest rates. One of the big ones is simply the fact that you've got all of that, all of those different default factors that can enter into the equation. Now, the next one is called the maturity premium. The maturity premium. And this one is everywhere adverse to the lender. So the longer the loan is, the more this maturity premium is going to be, because it stacks. Let me explain how it works. Follow with me. Okay, I've got you, sir, you're a lender, and you have lent me the money to buy a home. The interest rate was, let's say, 8%. Now, over a short period of time, interest rates probably won't move a lot. But as time goes on, there's more chance that interest rates will move, just because there's more time for something to happen. Suppose that interest rates fall to 5%. You lent me money at 8% 6 years ago. Interest rates are now at 5%. What am I going to do? Tell me.
Refi.
You better believe it. So you were expecting for 30 years to get 8% on the money you lent me. Now I am going to doggy drill you and give you back your loan and say now 5%. So I've suddenly screwed you out of that 8% you were expecting for 30 years. Now let's try the other side of it. And you have to keep this in mind. The average home is held in a decent economy for about 7 years before people buy a new house, pay that one off. Okay, now, you have lent me money at 8%. Suppose that interest rates go to 12%. Do you expect me to now do what is typical and pay off the loan in 7 years? Or do you expect me to hold on to that loan and stay in that house? You better believe it. See, if interest rates go up, you could be making 12% on that money you lent me. You'd really love to have me pay off that loan so you could get the money back and lend it out at 12%. I'm not going to do it. I'll stay in that Cracker Box house. Five kids, they can all use one damn bathroom. Yes, they can. If they can't, then go outside. I'll dig you a hole. You see, the whole thing there is that no matter which way interest rates go, the lender is screwed. If interest rates fall, I'll refi and give him back his money, and he won't be able to make as much on it. If interest rates go up, I'll hold on to a loan a lot longer than I would have, and so you would be deprived of the ability to use that to relend that money at the higher rate. The longer the time period, the more likely that the interest rates are going to move either way. It doesn't matter either way, the lender is hurt. So this maturity premium stacks up, so that you would see a maturity premium on a 3-year loan not as big as the maturity premium on a 7-year loan, not as big as the maturity premium on a 30-year loan. So this maturity premium causes interest rates to go up the longer the term of the lending agreement. So here's, by the way, an interesting thing. Treasury bills have no premium, no risk premium. But if you're talking about a treasury bond, it's not going to default, but it will have a maturity premium. in it because it's a long instrument. That's why when I said, well, the risk-free rate, we would look at a short-term T-bill. The reason we would look at a short-term T-bill is that we don't want to have that maturity premium adding in there. There's one more here. And I put it as K sub L, and you'll hear me call it the liquidity premium, although the book calls it the illiquidity premium. Either way, it works like this. Okay, we've got two different people have come to someone for a loan. You, madam, have a lot of money, so we're going to borrow money. This fine, upstanding, wealthy, reputable person comes from a great family. He has impeccable credentials, 4.0 grade point average. He wants to borrow $100 from you. And now he's prepared his agreement with you, and it's on nice parchment paper, and there's a notary and all that kind of stuff. I owe you $100 plus interest, blah, blah, blah. I'll pay you back exactly 1 year and 1 day from now, blah, blah, blah. Hold on. Okay, now, I come to you for money. I am not exactly reputable. I'm a hobo. And I need $100. Anyway, I'm going to write you an IOU. I got some toilet paper. Used it. I'll reuse the other side. I owe you $100. Hey, damn. Who are you going to charge more money to? Who are you going to charge a higher interest rate to? Understand that if you really needed your money back before a year and a day, you can always sell a loan agreement to someone else, and then they can collect the money. Which one of those two loan agreements is going to be easier for you to unload? The one that's on the nice parchment paper, notarized, and from a very reputable person, or the one from me that's written on a napkin that smells rather suspicious? You see, his will be easier to sell. The liquidity premium has to do with how quickly you can dispose of the instrument. If it's easy to get rid of it, get your money back if you need it in a pinch, you're going to have a low liquidity premium. If you're stuck with it, it would be really hard to get rid of it. You've got yourself a high liquidity premium. I'll give you a great example of this. As I told you, I had a penny stock house. Now, a penny stock house deals in stock that is essentially from companies no one's ever heard of. And the market for it is extraordinarily thin. If I have managed to sell in a primary offering, let's say 1,000 shares to some sucker or some customer, now, that person decides, okay, I really need to get rid of this stock because I'm kind of worried about it and I need the money anyway. You know what? I'm going to have a really hard time getting rid of that stock for him because I'll first of all have to call my network of other disreputable penny stock houses and see if anyone there's got an order in to buy this company stock. Oh, no one does today. Okay. Keep in touch with me. I'll find a way to see if I can talk down the price so this person will, so I can sell it to you. You want it? No, I don't even want it for inventory, and I sure as hell don't have anybody who's even heard of this company who wants to buy it right now. So basically, that stock is going to be really, really hard for me to unload. In some cases, I never got rid of penny stock for someone who wanted to unload it. I had a poor lady. She needed the money. I got stock in this company. I can't do anything for you. No one wants this stock. I'm sorry. Sorry about your luck. Now, take the counter example, another example. Let's say that you want to unload Microsoft stock. You're going to be able to unload that with a phone call or a click of a button on your computer. Just an instant sale. No liquidity problem whatsoever. It's just immediately it is sold. So that's where we get this idea of the liquidity premium. It is a risk factor having to do with how easily you can liquidate the security. If it's hard for a company to get rid of a loan, it's probably going to have a high liquidity premium. If it's easy for a company to get rid of a loan, it's going to have a low liquidity premium. So in the example of home mortgages, more or less almost all mortgages that are taken out, you know, you sign the papers, within hours, that loan has already been sold into a giant package with other loans sold into a giant pool to somewhere on the other side of the planet. It's gone. Those are so easy to sell. That's why the lenders have these standardized, perfectly arranged agreements so that they all look the same, so there's no question that they will be picked up into the pool of loans and then this all mashed together into these giant giant bonds and all that kind of stuff. But if you're talking about a bank lending money for some purpose like home remodeling, that might be a little different. I went to a credit union. I wanted to see if they could lend me the money so that I could modernize my photography equipment. They were very hesitant, and of course the interest rate was going to be pretty high on it. A lot of that was the liquidity premium. They can't get rid of that loan. They're going to be stuck with that thing through the ride that I wanted to have of 2 years on it. Together, again, these three animals constitute the risk premium. And so if I ask you in an essay question, what is the risk premium and what are the components of its structure? What is the risk premium and what are the components of its structure? The risk premium comprises the default premium, the maturity premium, and the liquidity premium. That's your answer. You say any more than that, I know very well that you don't know the answer. That's how I want you to answer questions for me. In business, we don't need you to go around the barn five times to find the outhouse. All we need you to do is tell what it is you know. Okay. We'll get to the banking system here. This actually keys back around to this K and to the specific components of it. Now, when I say banks, I could actually include a whole lot of different animals in that. There are all kinds of different charters for banks. And one of the worst problems in the world, in the United States at least, not in the world perhaps, is that there's this turf war that's built up over many, many years. People might think, well, there's a regulator for banks. Well, first of all, a bank is not just a bank. There are all kinds of different banks. There are banks for people. Then there are banks for banks. Then there are banks for businesses. And then there are banks that are chartered by the state. Some banks are chartered by the federal government. Some banks are watched by let me get it down to this. The idea that there is a single regulator of all banks in the United States, there isn't. And that was one of the big problems with the banking fiasco that was happening through the early part of the 21st century, of this century, was these banks were, different banks were being watched by different groups. Some banks are watched by state regulators. Some banks are watched by federal regulators. But there are different federal regulators. The Bank of Banks is called the Federal Reserve. It's an agency of the United States government. But it doesn't watch all federal banks. There are some federal banks that are watched by the FDIC. There are other banks that are watched by another regulator. So when you say, well, let's get all of these banks under a single regulator, oh, God, you're starting to talk about turf war. Everyone's defensive. All of these different agencies, well, I'm not going to give up the banks that I watch because I watch the banks and they're good, damn good. it's just like a fiasco trying to get everyone on the same page and everyone under a single regulatory system. The states sure don't want the federal government to start regulating their banks. The states say, we're fine. Our state regulators, we charter the banks, we watch the banks. Our circus, our monkeys, essentially. And so there's not a prayer that we would ever have a system where all banks would be watched by a single agency under a single set of rules. That's how bad it is. So, and then you've got, of course, these things that look like banks, but they aren't banks. For example, we've got credit unions. Credit unions look like banks, they act like banks, and for all intents and purposes, they are banks, except that they're not banks. There are things about them. For example, you put money into a checking account at a bank, B-A-N-K, and what you have is money in a bank that is in what is called a demand deposit. Checking account is a demand deposit. In other words, the bearer of a check can go in there and demand the money, and it has to be given to them right away. In other words, a checking account has extreme high liquidity. A demand deposit. And you would see these things called checking accounts. And the instruments, the drafts in them would be called checks, C-H-E-C-K. But if you're in a credit union, that thing that is in that account that you write checks on, it's not a demand deposit. It acts like one, and almost in any circumstance whatever, you could walk in with someone wrote you a credit union check, you could go in and cash it. But they don't have to. In fact, those are called negotiable order of withdrawal accounts, N-O-W, negotiable order of withdrawal accounts, NOW accounts. A credit union does not have to satisfy a demand on a negotiable order of withdrawal account. It almost always will right away, but it doesn't have to like a bank does with a demand deposit and a checking and a check. That's why if you watch carefully, you might notice that most of the time what's in a credit union would be those things that look like checks. It's spelled differently. I guess now they're even loosening up on that and they're allowed to spell them the normal way, but you've got to watch it. The same degree of liquidity does not exist in a NOW account as in a bank. So those credit union animals, they have special tax rules. They have their own regulatory agency overseeing them. They have their own requirements, regulatory requirements on them. Very different animal. And then you have all kinds of other things. For example, somewhat like credit unions, but they're banks. And they used to be extraordinarily popular, and they've gone down in popularity over the years, were what were called mutual banks. And I don't know if any of you have ever seen a sign for one. The way a mutual bank worked was if you said, I want to have a checking account, they actually would look you all over to determine if you were worthy, basically. Because if they let you have a checking account, you became one of the owners of the bank. And in that way, these mutual banks generally stayed quite fairly small. They were like community banks. And everyone who had a checking account in there was watching that bank like a hawk. You knew the president of the bank. He was in the town. He screws up, you're going to beat him up when he goes down the street. The mutual bank, everyone who had a checking account was an owner of the bank. And you can imagine those things were actually very healthy, very strong animals, and they lasted for decades and decades, but they're not very popular now. But there are still a few of those out there. Then there are all kinds of other animals. Like, for example, something that's not a bank, there are these savings and loans. They used to be just tons of them. And then there was a scandal and a crisis in the 1980s involving savings and loans. Related to those were what were called building and loans. And then there were other kinds of consumer lending things out there. Essentially, rich people would pool their money and then lend it to people at interest. So there were all kinds of different animals out there, and there still are to this day, although the types of them might have changed somewhat. So that's where we start with this. A maze of different types of financial intermediaries, institutional financial intermediaries, being regulated by different agencies at either the state or the federal level, and each of these regulatory agencies having its own oversight rules, having its own laws applied to it from the government, the incumbent government. So you got a lot of complications out there, and they're not being fixed at all, again, because of the turf wars. All of that having been said, let me get you to the Federal Reserve. This is the big 800-pound gorilla, the kahuna of the banks. Sometimes we call it the Fed. Really? The Fed. Back in the late 1800s, the financial system of the United States was just a fiasco. There were all of these different banks running around. Some of them were legit. Some of them were just as illegitimate as you could imagine. There were all of these investment scams going around, and there were all of these different meager requirements and rules that no one watched and no one followed. And then there were these rich, powerful men and families that were playing with the system like a boss. When a bank takes in a deposit, it keeps a little bit of that in the vault to satisfy demand deposits from that account. The rest it lends out. So on any given day, a bank would not be able to pay off all of its demand depositors, but it wouldn't really have to on a normal day. But if suddenly there were a rush on the bank, if everyone wanted his or her money back on the same day, like if they were afraid the bank was going to fail and they all wanted to get their money out, the bank would just collapse immediately. Just boom, like that. It would be gone. It would have to shut its doors and it would be out of business and everyone would be screwed. So these runs on banks were very common in the late 1800s. And essentially, a bad bank would start the run. Because everyone here, this bank doesn't have the money to pay anyone off, so everyone would run to that bank, and of course, then the bank couldn't pay everyone off, bank would fold. That would freak other people out who had accounts at other banks nearby, then they'd run to their banks, and that bank would fold because it didn't have the money. Of course it doesn't. It doesn't keep all of the people's money. It would fold, and it would be like this cascade effect where the run on a bank could sweep a city or even a region. You had major macroeconomic implications from these runs that were happening on banks. Some of them were actually being started by these rich people. Oh, I see a couple of banks that I'd like to get my hands on. Hey, by the way, did you hear that bank doesn't have money to pay you back? And suddenly, they would create a crisis, and then they would exploit it. Once the bank folded, they'd buy it for pennies on the dollar, and they'd have the bank charter, and they could monopolize cities or regions or neighborhoods. So it was all kinds of insanity going on. That was the era of laissez-faire. Leave it alone. Let business sort its own problems out. Government shouldn't get involved in anything. It'll work its own self out. The era of the classical and neoclassical economists. Capitalism will always solve its own problems. There's no need for government regulation. Well, that worked until some rich people who were politically connected started getting screwed in these kinds of bank scandals. And it worked until enough people got mad that you had some riots and some burning down of buildings happen. And then suddenly the government began to get a little more serious about, well, maybe we should have some kind of regulation, some central regulator. Eventually that happened in the second decade of the 20th century with the Federal Reserve Act of 1917. This act established a central bank for the United States. A central bank for the United States. And it gave that central bank broad authority to handle the banking system. As I said, though, that didn't last because the states still had their chartered banks, and then you had all these other animals out there. But the Fed began to exert control. The Fed divided the United States into 12 regions, and each region would oversee the banks in its region. Now, the funny thing is that the regions out west, this was all set up in the second decade of the 20th century. The regions out west were huge because hardly anyone lived out there. The regions in the east were real small because there was such intense banking activity on the east coast. Well, it's still that way today, even though you've got these huge regions out west, district banks out west. And they've got so much more activity these days. And then you've still got the tight little regions on the East Coast. There are 12 of these regions. Now, the entire system is overseen by a board of governors. There are 7 of these governors of the Federal Reserve. One of them is the chairman. There isn't 7 plus 1. There are 7 chairmen. There are 7 governors. These governors are appointed by the president with the advice and the consent of the Senate. These are, historically have been the cream of the crop of society, of finance, of banking, of industry. They impeccable. I've met some of them in my lifetime. They dress so well. They look great. I'm sure they never have sex. But they've lost their reputation to some extent over the past, especially over the past couple of decades, because you've had chairmen who started out really good and then they got spiteful and destructive, like Alan Greenspan, or they are obsequious and groveling, like Ben Bernanke. But the governors historically have been very reputable. And as I said, though, that has not been the case in recent years. There are some who have questionable credentials, questionable thinking. One of the governors who was appointed under the Bush administration, she had run a community bank until it was in such bad shape that it was taken over by a larger bank. And then her big thing that she did with her career was she was a dinner theater actress. Bush appointed her as a governor of the board. So it's not as good as it used to be, but there you go. Matter of fact, even Obama has appointed a few that are has appointed one that was quite questionable. Okay, the 7 governors regulate the banking system. So laws are passed by the Congress and signed by the president. And then the 7 governors create regulations pursuant to those laws. In other words, the framework is created by the Congress, as with many laws, and then the regulatory agency, in this case, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, interprets those so that they are operational for the banks. Then the 12 district bank presidents, the 12 district banks, each has a president. And again, these are highly reputable people, men and women of impeccable credentials. The district banks, and there's one in each district, although there are some branches, they then supervise the banks in their district according to the rules created by the regulators of the at the governor level. So the governors regulate, the district banks' presidents supervise. They go into the banks and they in their area and they keep an eye on them. Now, here, we're actually between, we're almost right on the border between two of the major heavies of the districts, the Chicago district and the St. Louis district. Which one are we in, do you know? I doubt, could you guess which one we're in? Yeah, we're in the Chicago, but it's just not too far south of here that the banks would be in the St. Louis district. Now, to give you an idea, different banks, they have a different character. It's kind of, it's always kind of been weird, and it's much more stronger now. So, for example, the St. Louis Fed Bank is a very, it's a bank very big on education of people, of students, of it's very much into providing a lot of data, very helpful people down there. And they enjoy, they seem to enjoy having people come down to see their bank. On the other hand, you go up to Chicago, that bank is just darn right mean. I took a group of my students up there to just walk in. They had a little place where you could see money and all that kind of stuff and see the history. It was a little museum in there. And, I mean, they were watching us like hawks. I was at the back of this line of my students. I had them go in first, and I was walking in behind them. And the guard, this big woman, hits me with a nightstick. You know, hey, yeah, damn, bitch. Yeah, that hurt. I mean, my knuckles were beating. You know, I wanted to see if she'd go out for dinner. But, you know, anyway, they were just nasty as hell down, up there. And then you go down to the Fed in St. Louis. Oh, yeah, come on in. Here. Look at this money over there. Don't touch it or we'll shoot you. But so you get a lot of different characteristics. One of the banks is very special. It's called the Empire Bank. That's the one in New York City. The Empire Bank is in New York, is the New York Fed. One thing you can always, one of the Fed's jobs is as acting as an agent of the United States Treasury. The Fed prints money and shreds money. So you can see where which Fed bank printed. What do you see on this one? There's its stamp right there. What do you see?
Atlanta.
And that's an F. That's the F bank, the Atlanta bank. This one was printed in Atlanta, which sort of explains the trailer park smell. But anyway. Oh, that was... Where the hell do I have... Well, God, I'm almost out of money. Okay, well, yeah, as you can see, well, there's a Cleveland, Chicago, St. Louis, San Francisco, Boston, the 12 different banks, and you can see physically what they, one of the things that they do. Okay, now, take you to what the Fed does. Fed has three jobs. I actually enjoy talking about this because there's this little hidden secret in here that, well, I'll get to it in a minute. Okay. One job of the Fed, one of its jobs, is that it regulates and supervises the banking system. Like I said, that's just one of its jobs. The governors make the regulations, and then those are enforced by the bank, the district banks. So that's one. The second one is one hardly anyone knows about. The Federal Reserve serves as a bank for banks. Banks need a bank. They need checking accounts like any other business does. The Federal Reserve serves this purpose, but in direct competition with private commercial banks to do the same thing. So if you have a bank, you could go and have your checking account with the Fed, or you could have your checking account with a commercial bank that does that for banks. So the Federal Reserve, an agency of the federal government, goes head-to-head with commercial banks with a couple of provisos. The Federal Reserve spends a lot of money on technology for clearing checks, for all kinds of telecommunications and all of that. It has to share everything it does with the commercial banks against which it competes. So if it gets a new way so that you can swipe your card and it will transact your business faster, it has to share that technology with all the banks it competes with. And also, the Federal Reserve, it has to turn over any profit it makes from being a bank for banks to the government at large. It can't just essentially make profit for itself. Technically, it can't make a profit at all, but that's not exactly there. Now, the interesting thing is, you might say, okay, well, in other words, banks have a public option. They don't have to get their commercial banking services from the government, but they can. So that might indicate to you, well, that commercial banks that did this would all be destroyed by this giant monster government agency that does the same thing. That was the argument against a national health care system where the government would offer health insurance in direct competition with private insurers. In fact, over many, many, many decades, since early in the life of the Fed, this system has been in force, and private commercial banks are doing just fine. So is the Fed. This system actually works. So the idea that a public option is somehow economically unviable and destroys private industry, you've got an example right here that doesn't happen. I called the St. Louis Fed. I've got a couple of fellow grad students from my back in the day who got reputable jobs at the Fed, and I called one of them down there in St. Louis. I said, I don't actually know the answer to this. How much of the percentage-wise banks in the United States get their commercial services done by you guys versus going through private commercial banks to do their banking services? And he had a number right off the top of his head. He said about 65% of the banks go with the Fed, 35% go with private commercial banks. And so I looked at those private commercial banks, see what their average profit was. It was really good. They just have 35% of the business. The Federal Reserve has 65% of the business. And everyone does well in this business. And the fees don't go out of line because the Fed just keeps the fees down so the commercial banks can't rip off the banks that use their services. So there you go. A public option is available for banks to get their banking services, but that just is not acceptable for people to get their health care, even though we have a perfectly good model that it will work and it will not destroy private industry. Let's go on to the third one, the giant one. The Federal Reserve conducts monetary policy. It adds money to the banking system. It extracts money from the banking system to regulate the money supply and control interest rates. That's what it does in this a part of its job. This is on an unelected body. The thought was, look, monetary policy could become a political football, just like taxes are. I mean, I want to lower your taxes. No, I'll lower them further until we don't have enough money for all of our big wars. They knew very well right off the bat that that was going to happen with monetary policy the way it was with fiscal policy. So we put that monetary policy over here with this independent agency called the Federal Reserve so that it could not be played with by politicians trying to gain favor. That was the whole reason. We didn't want monetary policy to end up like our tax policy, where congressmen and presidents fall all over each other to cut taxes so that they can get favor from someone. So the Federal Reserve operates its monetary policy with a mind toward controlling inflation. Know this, there is one and only one cause of inflation. That is when the growth rate of the money supply exceeds the real growth rate of the economy. Again, inflation can be caused only by the growth rate of the money supply exceeding the real growth rate of the economy. In other words, if there is too much money chasing the real growth, then there will be the excess money will just turn into price increases. It will be fluff. So the first job of the Fed is to control inflation. At the same time, it should be controlling deflation too, because if you don't have enough money for the real growth rate of the economy, you'll have a deflation, which is a nasty ass thing. It is bad. We would rather have an inflation than a deflation, trust me on that. And unfortunately, as I've written in a couple of venues, I'm seeing some scary signs of a deflation for some reason. How that could be happening, I don't know. But anyway, okay, again though, well, that union got an increase in its wages, or they raised the minimum wage, and that's going to cause inflation. No, it won't. It can't. Unless there is liquidity being pumped into the economy that creates inflation. Well, that company's profits went up. It raised its prices. That's going to be inflationary. No, it can't be. Only too much money being printed will create inflation. You raise wages? Well, that's great. You'll just have workers not with jobs. You have a company raise its prices, people will just move away from that good to another good. And then or they won't have enough money to buy other things. Either way, those can't create inflation. Only the Federal Reserve printing too much money can create inflation. So through the conduct of monetary policy, the Fed can control the money supply. It has three ways that it controls it. Now, these are from the rarest of use and the bluntest through to the most common and the most refined. The first way that it could change the money supply would be through what is called the required reserve ratio. Remember how I said banks keep a little bit of money on reserve so that they can pay back people who want money? You just got $100, just out of nowhere. It just kind of came to you, fell from heaven because you're a good person. So you come to me and you deposit that $100. Well, I have to keep some of it on reserve if you come back in and ask for some of it back. So let's say that that base, $100, I keep 10% on reserve. Now the other $90, you come to me and you say, I have a business plan and I want to borrow some money. Well, I've got $90 to lend. What's your business plan? I want to start a mail escort service. Indeed. What's its name? Rolf's Escort Service. Okay. I lend you $90. See this $90 that I had to lend? You set up his business, website, call service, you know, order by online, order online. And so he pays you the $90. You come back to my bank and you give me that $90 to put on deposit. Well, I'm going to keep 9 of it in reserve. Well, I'll be darned, I've got 81. So you can come to me and you say, I've got a business and I need some money. I've got $81. So what are you planning to do? Well, I was planning to, you know, I don't know, I sort of kind of was hoping that I could start some kind of a pizza parlor. Okay. So I give you $81, lend you $81. You pay him to build your pizza parlor. And so he comes to me and he puts that $81 in the bank. I keep on reserve 10% of it, and the remainder I can lend back out. Do you see what's happening to the money supply? On my balance sheet, look at that. It's growing, and there is no money involved. No extra money, just $100. And yet my balance sheet, the amount of capital on my balance sheet, is expanding. In the end, what will happen is it will be the original amount, M0, times 1 over the required reserve ratio. So in this case, that would be $100 times 1 over 10, 1 over 0.1, the 1 over 0.1, which equals $1,000 will be created by a deposit of just $100. So the Fed can move that required reserve ratio up and down to control how fast the money supply expands. So if it wanted to get the money supply growing real fast, it would drop the required reserve ratio. If it wanted to slow down the money supply growth, it would increase the required reserve ratio. It probably wouldn't do it for these reasons. Mostly, the Fed likes to keep the required reserve ratio somewhere so that banks, if people are worried about banks, we would probably bump the required reserve ratio up, just in case a lot of people ran on the bank. If we think that the economy is such that people are feeling really safe and they're not going to run on banks or get a lot of their money out, we would probably lower the required reserve ratio. The part that I didn't know until a couple of years ago, I had always assumed that there was one required reserve ratio, just never looked into it. It turns out that the required reserve ratio is different for different sizes of money in banks. I just found out, like I said a couple of years ago, that the required reserve ratio for the first $10 million tranche in a bank is actually zero. So in other words, you have an infinite growth rate. The second way that it can do this, control the money supply, is to change the discount rate. The bank can lend banks money. Most banks historically chose to borrow from other banks. But the Fed was always there. So this interest rate could go up and banks wouldn't borrow as much, or it could go down and banks would borrow more from the Fed. But it was there to help banks have more liquidity or to slow down the liquidity. And the third way is the open market operations. I'm going to put up an article for you to read tonight so that you'll get an idea of how open market operations work. And it's not that hard once you get the hang of it, but this is the most common of the techniques. That's all I have for you. I thank you.